Welcome to AM Best Audio.
Hello and welcome to this AM Best TV special presentation, Pushing Back the Risk Frontier, How Insurers Are Co-opting the InsurTech Playbook. I'm John Weber, along with Arun Balakrishnan, CEO at Exceedance. Arun, so glad that someone with your expertise and knowledge of the InsurTech revolution could join us today.
Thank you, John. Always a pleasure to be here.
So, Arun, over the past few days, we've been hearing from insurance and technology experts about how many insurers are incubating their own homegrown technology. Arun, before we listen to what those experts had to say, I wanted to get your thoughts. Do you think we're in something of a technology revolution as far as incubation goes?
I think it's, yes, you're right. And I think it's also not got to do with technology alone. I think there's a bit of a mix in leadership. If you look at CIOs at many insurance companies, reinsurance companies and others, brokers, many of them are in roles wherein they started as programmers themselves. So they as leaders are more comfortable with the build approach than buy. So yes, and that coupled with the ease of building solutions has led to creating a bunch of these incubation units within insurance companies. I agree with your observation.
So let's get started then, shall we? How insurers are incubating their own technology. We put that question to Scott Hawkins. Scott is a managing director and head of insurance research at Conning. Let's hear what he had to say.
Broadly speaking, I'd say it depends upon the size of the company. Now, we see insurers pretty much of all sizes participating in regional or local insurtech incubators or accelerators. We see that here in Connecticut or New York or Des Moines, for instance. We think these are really a popular way to provide a relatively low-cost opportunity for insurers of all sizes to participate in an incubator or accelerator. That said, however, larger insurers clearly are setting up their own incubators. You know, you can look at Allianz and Securian supporting the OnRamp InsurTech Accelerator in the Twin Cities. Lloyd's Lab in London supports a 10-week program, I think it is, for InsurTech startups there. AXA has an accelerator program. And here in Hartford, you have Nassau Re supporting Reimagine, which is an InsurTech accelerator for the Hartford and Connecticut community. But we think these large companies are really more the exception of the way carriers are playing in the InsurTech incubator space than the rule.
So Scott says it's more likely that it would be the larger companies developing their own technology incubators. Arun, do you think that's accurate? And if so, why?
See, I think if you look at the definition of incubators, right? I mean, it is really trying to tap into what is available externally and create a platform for innovation within your company. Incubators is a subtle way for telling innovation doesn't have to always happen in-house. So you're relying on, you know, incubating some of these from outside as well. So by definition, the larger ones become more appropriate for this. The smaller companies might not have the resources to kind of explore, but as Scott rightly pointed out, there are multiple platforms wherein incubators, which have created InsurTech enablers, and besides the ones you mentioned, there's ITC, you know, InsurTech Israel in different geographies, wherein companies are coming and creating these. But by and large, yeah, you're right. The larger company. There's another form of incubation, which I would say is corporate venture capital. You know, we have examples of like American Family, which have created a corporate venture arm, wherein they're not necessarily developing themselves, but they're investing in these and creating a different way to tap into innovation and talent pool.
So what are the motivations to develop tech incubators rather than acquiring the technology? Let's hear what June Kwa, the Vice President of Integrated Analytics at Munich Re North America Life, has to say about that.
There are definitely numerous motivations for the insurance industry to develop either incubators and accelerators, or actually even developing the technology in-house rather than forming partnerships or acquiring startups. I see it as two main themes. Firstly, it relates to a company's strategic vision and long-term goals for innovation. And secondly, the flexibility, especially with large companies, whereby they want that flexibility to customize and develop solutions that are tailored for their use cases and that fit the needs of their consumers. So from a strategy perspective, that there's so much going on in technology today, I think insurers really need to continue to innovate, to stay ahead, and to remain competitive. And they should always be asking themselves, like, does it really make more sense to build or to buy, and how that aligns with their long-term vision. And then ultimately, I think, especially in areas where insurers have domain expertise, it can make a difference in terms of the success or the failure of an initiative, whether they're doing it on their own or with incubators, or whether they are partnering with an external party. And now, at the end of the day as well, I think doing it on your own gives you that ability to generate new intellectual property, which can give you a big competitive advantage and help you stand out in the market.
So Arun, I was struck by the line, does it make the most sense to build or buy? I guess there really is no one size fits all, is there?
No, there isn't. And, you know, it's really horses for courses there. But the balance between build and buy has been changing. Like I mentioned, you know, there was this age-old thing of you don't get fired for hiring IBM, which was the culture in many CIO divisions. So the general answer for many large companies used to be to buy rather than build. But that mix is changing a lot. And it could be, as pointed out earlier, for IP reasons, or something so unique which is not out there. But the reasons for build needs to be correct. It should not be, it will cost me much lesser. That is the worst reason to do it. IP, super specialization, these are all good reasons.
All right. So then what do insurers need to do when it comes to playing catch up in the development of technology? Eric Weisberg is a senior principal at Datos Insights. This is what he had to say.
A lot of the things that we've heard today are part of that, right? So I would say that, as June had mentioned, you really need to understand what use cases you're trying to solve for. On top of understanding that use case, you know, understanding your business case, right? So and understanding what the value is, and so how much can you afford to invest in it. Then having success criteria so that when you're done running your test of the insurer technology, you know whether it's been a success or not. And having a plan to deploy and implement once you've decided that the tech is good. Time boxing these projects makes a lot of sense, right? So you could easily, you know, consume all your resources for the entire year, you know, perfecting the implementation or the testing of a piece of tech, but then you're looking at a fewer number of technologies, right? So if I time boxed my proofs of concept to 60 days, I'd be able to get six times as many done in a year as if I gave myself the full year. And as June mentioned, also, you know, being able to embrace failure, right? So, you know, we're testing these things. They can't all be great. They can't all work, and they shouldn't all be implemented. So the problem that the insurers have is it's an industry where you have a real advantage with a low expense ratio, right? It's really what separates the top performers from the also-rans. Well, if you have a low expense ratio, you don't have a lot of slack in your system to invest in experiments, right? And so I think that's the needle that needs to be threaded for the insurance industry. I think they need to find a way to maintain a competitive expense ratio and still have the funds in order to invest for innovation.
Wow, there's a lot to unpack there, Arun. But I think the thing I was most struck about was the line about being able to embrace failure. That's a pretty tall order, especially when you're under the gun for ROI, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And the many reasons why companies, when they're in-house trying to build, if you had to rank the number one reasons why these projects don't meet the desired outcome, it is because of the worry of failure, right? Or how it will be perceived. Imagining yourself, you know, when you have to present to the committee, which is appointed by the board, or you have to present showing to your CEO the first demo internally and it fails, the fear of that often makes makes it much harder. A very key part of product development or innovation is making mistakes and being able to define your minimum viable product, what is exactly needed, knowing that you're out, you won't have a Ferrari on day one, right? I mean, you start with the chassis, show that it works. And that approach and mindset is extremely critical to the culture of innovation and building. And without that, it's very hard to manage large-scale teams doing that.
Thanks, Arun. We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, we'll take a look at how insurers are co-opting the InsurTech playbook. This is AM Best TV.
Accelerate your insurance business with Exceedance. From consulting to digital platforms, Exceedance empowers 200-plus insurance organizations with AI-driven solutions, deep expertise, and operational excellence. Learn more at Exceedance.com.
We're back, and we're speaking with Arun Balakrishnan, CEO of Exceedance, and we're going to take a look at some of the innovative approaches that are driving the transformation of the insurance industry. Arun, I would have to imagine that you've been impressed with some of the innovative things that you've seen in recent months.
Oh, absolutely. I think generative AI is one of the most disruptive technologies to come out in recent times, and the pace at which it is being adopted in businesses, in insurance, has been far more encouraging to me than some of the ones which in recent times. I mean, if you recall 5-6 years ago, there's a lot of wave about blockchain being able to disrupt the industry and everything, but it never made its way to boardrooms, key decisions and everything. That's not the case with large language models. The pace at which companies have adopted it, creating basic use cases, it's not just for business-oriented functions, but internally how to consume it. Organizations all over are trying to embrace it, not just in the manner of having your innovation team look at it. You know, it's actually various teams are trying to experiment with it. But the most remarkable thing has been the pace at which this has made its way, not just into businesses, but into consumers and our lives as well. So I can't even imagine the business of insurance, the business in general, how it's going to be disrupted in the coming decade.
Yeah, really. Well, we spoke with Paul Mattern, senior principal at Datos Insights, and asked him, how can organizations set up an innovation model? Let's hear what he had to say.
And at Datos Insights, we see kind of four types of innovation to help you define it. The exploratory, where you're just trying something out. So let's say with AI, when it first came out, just what's the art of the possible, if you will. And then moving from there to the experimental, where you might try particular use cases to bring it across. And moving forward, then maybe tactical, you have current issues or current challenges that you want to face. And then strategic, where you're really looking at new markets, new products, things to bring out. So very important to understand when you're doing it. The other things that are important to consider when working through your innovation is to think about, is this really an enterprise and a business and IT, or is it an IT only? And I think that's a key thing to think through, as well as when you're organizing, are you going to centralize or are you going to really federate something like this? So some organizations will actually put everything in one place, have a chief innovation officer, and then work through it in that way. Other people will federate, may have champions that are out there as well too. And I think when you think about the why, a lot of what you're doing with innovation is to differentiate yourself.
You want to differentiate yourself. How do you do that, Arun? How do you set yourself apart from the competition when it comes to innovation?
I think at the heart of it, which I discussed with the insurance, is, you know, it's the customer, right? So you got to, the best way to differentiate is in the experience for your customer. And that's at its primal form is in two manners. One is the whole buying process and how you interact with them and manage them during that life cycle. And the second is claims. unfortunately, a very small percentage of your policyholders goes through that service side of experience of yours. So out of these two, companies who really want to differentiate need to identify their core value proposition, whether it's price, whether it's convenience, whether it's coverage, or just ease of doing business or claims paying. You need to deploy AI and innovation in that direction. AI is really about enhancing your strengths and not trying to cover your weaknesses, right? I think many try to use innovation, be it AI or tech, to really cover their weaknesses. Whereas I always believe innovation and the strength of technology comes by being a multiplier for what you already are very good at. And the companies which do that they are the ones who show remarkable progress in this. And that's what we're seeing too.
Interesting philosophy. Now, obviously, one of the most important aspects of the insurance industry is the underwriting process. We wanted to find out if companies can integrate their underwriting processes with homegrown technology. We put that question to Chris George. He's the managing director of MIS, a resource pro company. Here's what he had to say.
Yeah, the focus on that underwriting process, and especially when you get to the larger carriers, you have the legacy systems, and then you have the newer tech. What we're seeing in the marketplace is the ability to organize, especially when you have business partners that may be in the business process outsourcing side all the way to the agency side. And so organization of the data flow as we're renewing and executing new opportunities is the ability to have a workbench, right? Workbenches give the availability to have the agent, the underwriter assistant to go through that whole process from OFAC to subjectivities to rate quote bind bill capabilities to execute, renew, endorse, and renew, and also keep the day-to-day operations going. But it's that struggle back and forth between the legacy and the new, and the new technologies with the APIs and the ability to, you know, kind of go right through and foster collaboration and execute. And everybody knows what everybody is doing to execute that constant back and forth between the players from the insured all the way to the agent, the MGA, as well as the carrier, and keeping everybody on task and executing and getting the things done. But the workflow management of the ability with workbenches to organize and execute has been a huge success in the last several years. And I think it's only going to get better and better as continual use of those systems, working with larger legacy to newer technologies as they continue to build out.
So Arun, Chris talked about that concept that he called workbenching. What do you think of that?
I mean, workbenches in different shapes and forms, we've tried to build this over several years, right? I mean, even with if you have to optimize the workflow of an underwriting process, in given the number of stakeholders involved, say if it had to take a large property account, right? You have to get it CAC modeled, then my risk inspections, your ops team involved, and brokers, negotiations. So often having an ability to keep a track of something through the whole journey and leveraging tech to enhance your underwriter's efficiencies towards focusing more on risk selection and pricing than on moving data around has been the dream and the wish list now. Prior attempts at that, I would argue, haven't been that successful, largely because of the high level of subjectivity involved in the underwriting process, especially in specialty lines and E&S business. But again, bringing back to generative AI and the potential of large language models is here, extraction is not just a location-based thing. It's, you know, the ability to comprehend documents and extract it to create a meaningful experience for the underwriter has been enhanced. So I think the quality of underwriting workbench solutions is going to dramatically change in the coming years. And I would say this is an area wherein I struggle to see one solution which will become the standard for the industry. This is one of the places wherein I feel companies' innovation will really drive it, because underwriting is so contextual and so values driven, so specific to each company, that here companies will adopt large language models and generative AI to create their own in-house workbenches, and which is customized to their SOP, their risk standards, their philosophy. And they're going to be a lot more of build in this case than buy.
Interesting. Now, one of the things that we haven't talked about here today is the Internet of Things, or IoT for short. Let's find out about IoT adoption and how that's being developed in-house. Jeff O'Shaughnessy at HSB had this to say about IoT.
Thanks, John. You know, the exciting thing is that over the past several years, the market has proven that sensors and IoT, common acronym for the Internet of Things, and bringing technology and sensors into the insurance world, it's working. We've proven that, particularly losses such as water, freeze, fire, are either preventable or certainly we have the ability to mitigate them considerably. And so, for example, at HSB, we've been working for years to develop not just devices, but proprietary algorithms that are built into those, and really a full stack of services that go along with that, which are critical to having a full sensor program alongside the insurance program. So what we're really seeing is that a lot of the primary carriers, and it's all shapes and sizes, from small regionals to nationals, and of course, multinational carriers, across a wide range, they are incorporating this and having success in lowering loss ratios and achieving a significant ROI when implementing sensors as part of their insurance coverage.
Arun, do you expect to see even more development of IoT for the purposes of insurance in the coming years?
John, if I could be honest, I don't think the adoption of IoT has been realized to its potential in ways it should be. To me, if I think about the future also, I am not as bullish about the ability of IoT to really penetrate into the insurance process. Not because of the potential of it. I think there's a lot of potential. But the framework of being able to adopt and incorporate real-time data into the whole insurance journey, that requires an overhaul of systems, that requires an overhaul of our processes. So yeah, in loss prevention and other sensors have played a material role. But the true value is when, you know, you build your IoT data as a live feed into your insurance program and the ability for the program to become, you know, dynamic in nature, dynamic pricing, you know. These are all elements which, when you adopt truly, is when the IoT device's potential comes out. Otherwise, it's a thing of the past. So you're taking an older process, putting in something new and hoping it'll give magical results. It doesn't work that way. So for true adoption of IoT into insurance, I think we need a bit of an overhaul of everything.
Interesting. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, new models for managing a successful insurance tech evolution. This is AM Best TV.
Accelerate your insurance business with Exceedance. From consulting to digital platforms, Exceedance empowers 200-plus insurance organizations with AI-driven solutions, deep expertise, and operational excellence. Learn more at Exceedance.com.
We're back. I'm John Weber, and my guest is Arun Balakrishnan from Exceedance. And we're going to dive into how insurance companies are pioneering new technologies to drive innovation. Arun, we use the phrase pioneering new technologies. Do you think in some respects it almost feels like the wild, wild west in the way technologies are being developed in insurance?
Oh, that's true. I mean, I think that's an accurate description. Anything about it, we have all shapes and forms. This is happening in today. You have the large incumbents who've been around for a few hundred years, exploring all forms from, you know, incubators to in-house tech to ecosystem, however you call it. And then you have a bunch of companies, which I call technologists who are outsiders to the insurance industry, are coming in, trying to change and create new disruptive models. And we have agencies which are relying on completely different things. So everybody's trying to solve it in pieces, right? And everybody's focused on trying to solve their problem. So that's why if you look at it, there isn't a major market-driven initiative or, you know, a major market-defining technology coming into play. So yeah, but you never know what comes out of it. You know? Things out of sometimes being this half as hard is also good.
Well, we asked Sanka Basu, product director at Resource Pro, what are the challenges people need to keep in mind when developing technology in-house? Let's listen.
There are a couple of things. I think one of the most important is having key domain knowledge. Our industry is complex. Our industry is complicated with lots of different process rules, regulations, regulatory, and having that knowledge in-house will ensure that our technology is being developed and deployed effectively. And I think something else that we all need to be aware of is the implementation of the technology. It's one thing to build it, it's another to deploy it, and making sure that the planning goes in to making sure that deployment is successful. We need to put together an end-to-end plan when we are releasing new technology into our environment to fully understand the impact of that technology so we can continue to have business as usual in an improved manner.
I was struck by something that Sanka said, and he said, we need to make sure the technology is being developed and deployed by people who really know the industry. Do you think that what he's saying is that the people who are strictly tech need to back off just a bit and make room for the people with institutional insurance knowledge and know-how? And if so, do you go along with that, Arun?
I wouldn't use the word back off, right? I would just say it needs to be a bit more collaborative. I think there's room for both. Sometimes the perspective, which is coming outside in, goes a long way. And the strengths of what they bring to the table is valued as well. I think that needs to be better. It's not an either-or case, right? I think there should be better platforms and better mechanisms of collaboration. And that collaboration is what will take the industry forward, right? So, but it's a bit of a camp structure today, right? It's like this is the technologist outsider camp and the incumbent experts camp. I think there's room for both to collaborate and, you know, really make 1 + 1 = 11.
Now, we have to assume there must be a best practice playbook when it comes to developing a homegrown AI system or process. We asked Harim Naveed, AVP of Integrated Analytics at Munich Re, about that. Here's what she had to say.
So Sanka talked about the effort it takes to launch an AI system into production or deploy them. And the best practices when you're developing an AI model is to ensure that it will act as you intended it to in production. So there's a few key parts to this. Ensure that there's parity between the development environment and the deployment environment. Make sure that when you build and test a model on your local machine, it works how you think it works in production. And there's principles you can adopt from software engineering that can be leveraged here. The other piece is to ensure that your service is stable. What if you get 100 requests at the same time? Is it going to fail? How is it going to fail? How do you let the customer know? And also, how do you ensure that you know the limitations of your technology before putting it out there into production so you can set expectations appropriately? The other piece is you have to ensure that your AI system is bias tested and monitored according to both the best practices for the use case and the regulatory conditions for the industry. So as we all know, insurance is a heavily regulated industry. We have to generate, and it actually is the one industry where AI is being regulated by the actual industry. So by the state commissioners, they are developing the requirements around documentation and filings around AI models that are being used in production. So you have to generate a lot of required documentation and sign-offs as required by that environment. Now, a lot of other industries don't have this problem. They can focus on just the technical best practices. But in the insurance industry, we also have to focus on what the regulatory best practices, because if you miss a filing date or a deadline, you may have to roll back your system from production. So, you know, to sum all of that, there's all the technical best practices that we can adopt from machine learning engineering, software engineering, those aspects in the development and deployment. But then there's regulatory best practices that the industry is very familiar with because we've been operating in this context for a very long time.
Now, Harim talked about bias. This is really a huge issue these days when it comes to insurance and technology, isn't it, Arun?
There is, right? I think the just given the fact how generative AI and large language models have been trained on, it's from content which is created by us, right? And there is bias in society, it's bias in the writings, in times. And we've trained models on different periods of literature and everything as well, right? So bias is inherently there. I'm not sure when you're competing against the kind of computing power which AI has, whether you can accurately test for every situation. Is, you know, and it's hard one to solve. But my view on how to address bias is what I call triangulate, right? So instead of having humans test it out, have three different AIs produce outputs and triangulate on that basis. And I think that kind of a methodology is more scalable, you know, wherein you create a maker checker out of AIs itself. Getting humans to try to eliminate bias or test for every bias situation is, I feel, an unrealistic solution.
So how and where are insurers deploying AI technologies that they develop themselves? We put that question to Mitch Ween, an executive principal at Datos Insights.
It's a great question. Actually, very, very few carriers are building small language models. The vast majority are subscribing to large language models, which are provided by vendors, and using retrieval augmented generation and context windows to get outcomes they want. However, there are cases where a small language model is a better choice. Why? Because they control the model themselves. They build it using open source toolkits. And it may, in fact, be cheaper. It may allow the carrier to narrow the model's coverage to be much more specific. And actually, it may allow for training or retraining to take place in a much more comprehensive and tested way. So responding to the regulators or responding to very, very niche type of requirements may mean a small language model is better. The reality, though, is carriers, for the most part, are not doing that unless they're fairly large and can attract the kind of talent you need to build out a small language model. So we estimate that really less than 1% of insurers ultimately will build their own SLMs. In terms of fine tuning them, maybe 5%. So it's going to be a small group that really uses small language models, but there's definitely a place for it.
So Arun, what's your opinion on small language models relative to large language in the insurance industry?
John, I agree with Mitch's comments about the relevancy of small language models for insurance companies because it allows it to be very contextual. It can be cheaper. You can use open source tools to create that for very specific problems which your company is facing. Although I wouldn't necessarily recommend that to be the first step or the first port of call on AI for any insurance company or an entity in this, right? So, because let's understand one thing is adoption and using AI is not just about our ability to build some of this. It's also an organization's mindset needs to change about how to rely on AI, right? So my impression would be that first adopting some of the off-the-shelf LLMs for doing some of your basic work, the low-hanging fruit, getting familiarity with relying on large language models and creating that as a layer on top of which you can deploy SMLs, SLMs for specific tasks is probably a more efficient path rather than building just your own small language models or relying on the LLMs.
Well, we certainly have covered a lot of ground here today, and this has been a truly fascinating discussion. So Arun, what's your takeaway from all this today?
I think we're one of the most exciting times, not just in the insurance industry, but in the world in general, right? And I think the potential of AI to disrupt how we do business in insurance is tremendous. And you heard some good, interesting thoughts about it. I could leave the viewers and everyone with one question is, are we really ready for it, right? Because if you think about AI, our world is very used to especially insurance executives or insurance companies, we've used technology and software in a very deterministic mindset. You give it something, the answer is always the same. You know, you're used to a deterministic approach to it. AI introduces a whole new element of You know, it's stochastic. You know, in the end, every time the output might be different, right? So it requires a mindset change. It requires us to really evolve in how we think about leveraging it. So the most successful ones are going to be the ones who prioritize AI culture and adoption of that value system and how we coexist with AI rather than jumping on the bandwagon of just getting AI to solve it. So it was, like I said, one of the most exciting times we've been in.
Are we really ready for it? I think we're going to find out sooner than later, Arun.
Absolutely, John.
Thanks, Arun. Well, that's our show. We hope you enjoyed. You can find the entire four-part program, How Insurers Are Co-opting the InsurTech Playbook, on our website at ambest.com. We would like to thank Exceedance for sponsoring this special presentation. For AM Best TV, I'm John Weber.
Looking to get the full attention of the insurance industry? We have the platforms that will do just that. Whether it be AM Best TV, AM Best Audio, Best Review Magazine, or Best Day. Find out more by calling AM Best Advertising Sales at 908-439-2200, extension 5399, and have a great day.